are algorithms that are used as a form of social control. I call them weapons of mass destruction.
My position is not that there should be no regulation.
Who the hell elected you?
Privacy means people know what they're signing up for.
And I'm sorry.
Welcome to Canaries in the Net, a podcast on propaganda, hybrid warfare, and social media algorithms. We've been doing our podcast in Czech language for almost 2 years, and we've released more than 50 episodes already. Our today's episode with our special guests represents a start of our English spin-off. And we are starting big. Today, we have a special guest we did not even hope for. It's Tomas Hendrik Ilves, former president of Estonia.
We were lucky because we were with Mr. President at the same conference on digital propaganda and information security in Prague a couple of weeks ago, where we have asked him if he would come to our podcast.
And here we go. Canaries in the Net are here to offer you an interview with this really extraordinary politician. We talked about the war in Ukraine, experience with Russia, hybrid warfare in China. We are
Josef Horý
and Alex Alvarová. Enjoy and welcome.
Mr. Ilves, welcome to our podcast.
Great to be here.
Thank you for coming. We probably cannot start with other topic than Russia's aggression against Ukraine. The war has been going for almost 8 years and 4 months of the atrocities at scale, and now with no end in sight. By attacking Ukraine, Putin has essentially negated the post-World War II global order, hasn't he?
Yes, well, I mean, we saw it was breaking down already for a while. I mean, you can divide things up, I would say, into three periods. The first is the post-war and or Cold War period, largely led by the United States with the Bretton Woods Institution, the UN, the Marshall Plan, the Berlin Airlift, NATO, etc., to actually form a rule-based society, and also with the GATT, which later became the WTO. And that was initially US-led, but then throughout the Cold War, we had NATO, and we had two sides. Then 1989 to 1991, the Cold War period ended, and we began, as we all know here on this podcast in our respective countries, with the post-Cold War era, which included all kinds of druzhba narodov, or kind of love of each other.
Yeah.
Russia is great. Russia will become a democracy. While the peace dividend or demilitarization of Europe. And then that continued for, well, it's hard to say. For some people, it continued until February 24th this year. And then for other people, it continued until August 8th of 2008, or maybe till February 27th, 2014, those being the dates of Russia's invasion of Georgia and the invasion of, the occupation of Crimea and the pseudo-states of the Luhansk and Donetsk so-called People's Republics. And since 2008, I think there have been widely different perceptions of what era we were in. Clearly, even after, a year after 2014, Germany still signed the Nord Stream 2 agreement. In 2019, we had Emmanuel Macron saying that we have to form an alliance with Russia to pull it away from China. I think that those of us in Central and Eastern Europe, or you might call us the Zwischenländer, or the countries in between, did not really count much, and our opinions did not count for much, and we were largely dismissed until 24 February, when suddenly we could all say, we told you so. And now we've been in here for 4 months, and clearly we think that the post-Cold War era is over. And I think there are a number of leaders in Western Europe who don't want it to be over and want to go back as quickly as possible to some kind of status quo ante. But, well, I don't know. We'll see what happens. I don't know when this will broadcast, but it'll be quite interesting to see when Draghi, Macron, and Scholz take their the good three kings from the West go to Kiev, you know, sort of on like January 6th, the kings from the East came to see the baby Jesus. So now we're going to go see the baby Zelensky.
What do you think are their intentions and why are they going there?
I don't know. Being from Central Eastern Europe and seeing the attitudes of at least two of those countries for the past 30 years, but especially since 2008, we have, I think, it's kind of a legitimate to just be a little suspicious. As we know, those countries would like as quickly as possible to restore relations with Russia. And the only thing they can actually offer is candidate membership to the EU. We'll see how that goes. Is that enough for the Ukrainian people? I don't know. I don't know what their plans are.
Putin was telling us about his true intentions for years, at least since the Security Conference in Munich in 2007, where he gave his famous speech criticizing and essentially denying the then current global security architecture. How come the West was so deaf to his words for so long?
I don't know, especially since within 2 months of that speech, he had conducted the first massive cyber attack on Estonia, which really was the first to actually fill von Clausewitz's definition of war, which the continuation of policy by other means. I mean, it was a state-on-state attack. And of course, we went to NATO. They didn't believe us, except for the United States and the UK. But everyone else said, oh, you're just being Russophobic. I mean, this was said by people who couldn't tell the difference between a laptop and a toaster oven, but what can you do? So it's, the evidence has been there constantly, and it has been denied. I mean, there is this attitude, I would call it anti-empiricist, as in you do not believe experience. So you do not believe the Eastern and Central European experience when they say, well, we understand this. You know, today is June 14th, the anniversary of some deportation of up to like 100,000 people from Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania all day in cattle cars to Siberia. So we know what this is about, right? I mean, I don't want to talk about other countries, but we know what they do. And they just refuse to listen to us. So what can you do? That's where we are. Now, I mean, it really took the 24th of February for anyone to start taking this stuff seriously, unfortunately.
However, we are quite dependent on Russia in terms of fossil fuels. Mostly gas, right? And EU, European Union, has laid out a plan to end our dependence on their gas, but that plan will take several years to accomplish.
Yep.
What do you think is the risk that Putin will turn off the gas this winter or play with the knobs?
Well, I think it's quite high. I mean, he's willing to do all kinds of things. I would not put it past him. Of course, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania in 1991 and 92, when everyone was gushing over how democratic Russia was, they turned off our gas and we had a very cold winter. And we're much further north.
Okay. And what do you think will happen if he does that? Will European countries share the gas with each other, or how is this going to play out?
Well, I think you'll see a number of countries saying we should end sanctions. I think that's what's going to happen, yeah.
Okay, no, at least we should be prepared. He's certainly using any means available, because he never hesitated to use any means available.
I mean, we know all this. The problem is that that our friends more to the West don't want to accept the reality that we have seen are here.
Yes, and they are in constant denial.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you have kind of organizations in Germany, for example, the Ostausschuss, which doesn't, or the Eastern Committee, which couldn't care less about us. They just want to make money with Russia. And the funny thing, of course, is that even Germany, it exports much less to Russia, even before all this mess, than it does even to Poland. And then you add if the Czech Republic and Slovakia, and you see these huge markets that they make a lot more money off Central and Eastern Europe than they do off Russia. But nonetheless, this kind of naive belief is there.
Maybe let's look at the global consequences of this war. It's even for Germany, it's now more present than before. Ukraine is a major world supplier of wheat. A lot has been recently written and said about the danger of world hunger caused by the disruption of global food supply chains. For example, director of the United Nations World Food Programme, David Beasley, has warned the audience at the World Economic Forum in Davos that hundreds of millions of people are endangered by hunger. This in turn may cause new and massive migration waves from Africa to Europe. It means Germany, France, the entire European Union, and the election combined. How serious do you think this threat might be?
I think it'd be quite serious, since we've already seen the weaponization of immigration by Belarus with the connivance of Russia, most clearly, or the approval of Russia this past winter. And I think that's kind of like now strikes me as kind of a preparation or sort of a trial run. Because it's clear once you get massive famine in, say, northern Africa, you're going to have huge movements of people. And I think that he's planning on that.
We are basically engaging in an arms race while missing the broader picture. Aren't we having a wrong perspective of the conflict? Has this always been a part of Putin's broader strategy?
I don't think he thinks that far ahead. I think he's kind of ad hoc. Russia, in fact, is an adhocracy, a term you heard before in a different context. But they do what needs to be done when the situation arises. Clearly, he started out thinking he was going to take Kiev in 2 or 3 days, and then it didn't work, so he had to do something different. Hard to say where it's going to go, but I think we should be prepared. Of course, one of the big issues that we don't see, we don't see any firm action on the part of the European Union to actually sort of have the European Union go in and start transporting grain.
Let's now have a look on the United States, which has been the main guarantor of European security. But at least since Trump came to power in 2016, we have seen a growing polarization of American society and various disruptions to stability of their institutions. While in the office, Trump had also been questioning the purpose of NATO. What impact will the expected victory of Republicans in the midterm elections later this year have on the war in Ukraine, European security and transatlantic relations as a whole? What if Donald Trump or someone like him wins the presidential elections in 2024?
Well, Donald Trump comes back in, I think we'll have a very serious problem with U.S. participation in NATO. But it's too early to tell whether he will really be the Republican candidate. Of course, it's not clear whether also what some of the other contenders will be like. But there is a strong isolationist trend in the Republican Party, as we've seen. It's still a minority in the Republican Party, but it's substantial enough to be worrisome, I would say. And of course, with the presidential system that you have in the United States, the president can decide things that maybe elsewhere is a little more difficult. And so we should be prepared for a difficult time beginning in 2024. Not that we can do much about it, but certainly prepare ourselves.
Do you think Macron's vision of European security autonomy is a viable path forward? Or how should we prepare?
Well, I think all of us need to dramatically increase our defense expenditures. That's really part, I mean, a major part of it. I mean, NATO will remain NATO because you'll have still be North Atlantic and the Canadians won't leave, certainly. So it'll still be transatlantic, but, you know, without the U.S., it'll be a considerably weaker organization.
Yeah, the hijack of opinion of the Republican majority opinion on that is actually the crucial problem.
It's not a majority yet, but it's still a very large part of the Republican Party. But the other thing is the president can unilaterally step out of NATO and then it takes a year to come into force. So if he decides on January 2024 that the U.S. will pull out of NATO, that means that that will take effect on January 20th, 2025, because that's the nature of the treaty.
That's actually 1 year to prepare, right?
Well, I think we should prepare now. On strategic autonomy, that's kind of a loaded term because it really is part of this larger anti-American mood in some countries in Western Europe. I mean, that's simply silly at this point, right?
Exactly. I just wanted to say it's just connected to a massive wave of Russian propaganda in Europe. So we didn't contain it. We are still running behind the train while the driver of the train is sitting in Moscow.
Well, the question is, how much influence does it have? I think that varies from country to country. I would say certainly in my part of the world, Russian disinformation, since we've gotten used to it, we've had it for 31 years or even more, but people take those things much less seriously. And we've seen all kinds of stories about us or what goes on in our countries, and people don't really take it seriously. And things such as anti-vaxxer propaganda, it seems is spread by Russia, but not directly affecting, I mean, not really about Russia-Europe relations. That seems to have more of an effect. But in any case, I would say that it will certainly keep this going.
On the 4th February this year, Vladimir Putin met with Xi Jinping in Beijing, and they signed a mutual agreement declaring a new era in the global order, endorsing their respective territorial ambitions in Taiwan and Ukraine, and stating that the friendship between two nations has no limits. So why has China been so quiet in respect to the war in Ukraine?
Because I think they don't quite know what is going on. I mean, they don't want to be too closely identified if it really goes bad. And so it has been relatively quiet. I mean, they make noises occasionally, sort of supporting Russia or... But, you know, it also runs against their positions for years about sort of about not interfering in other countries. And it's hard to say, you know, we have to stand up against interference in other countries and then support Russia at the same time. So it's difficult. They're in a tough position on this. And of course, then the other side of that is, they do believe that Taiwan is part of their own country. So they say, well, that's a completely different matter. But nonetheless, the idea of Russia attacking an independent country such as Ukraine is problematic ideologically for China.
Can we expect any escalation of the situation around Taiwan, or will they just play the longer game?
I really don't know. I mean, it's something I don't know what's going on really in that relation. China has seen that it might be a tougher thing than they think, and that the world reaction could be quite harsh.
Let's look at the potential outcomes of this war. How and when will it end? What do you think?
It's very hard to say. I mean, after all, it is ongoing, and it's turned into a war of attrition, and it's how many each side can kill on the other side. And that is not good. And what you're pitting is a Russian army with almost limitless troops and artillery in the best place for artillery against a smaller nation, but with an incredible will to fight. So how that ends is very hard to say. Whereas I could see that a really bad outcome in Ukraine for the Russians could see a collapse of the Russian invasion because people don't want to do it anymore. And there are enough indications there that many people who are even fighting don't want to fight. I don't see that happening on the Ukrainian side until it gets really bad. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I read the same newspapers that you do.
So in those newspapers, some analysts are saying that or predicting that this will become a frozen conflict. And then as the international pressure will mount, Ukraine will be pushed to close some agreement, some sort of agreement like giving up Donbas region or something like that. And if this happens, then the question is, what will Ukraine become? Will it become a South Korea, so technologically advanced country, which is in constant tension with its neighbor? Or will it be Israel, constantly fighting for its survival with a strong military culture?
Well, whatever is left of Ukraine will certainly be like Israel, I think. And I think lots of us will be like Israel.
In what sense?
Well, I think that certainly Central and Eastern Europe will spend considerably more on defense than we have, even if we are already at 2% or more. But, you know, I was just looking at defense expenditures in Western Europe during the Cold War. That's where there were no numbers about any of our countries, but it was pretty high. I mean, the countries that today are 1.2%, they were doing 2.5%, 3%. And that was when there was no war in Europe. That was just the Cold War. So I think that defense expenditures, especially if you go the route of strategic autonomy, I mean, you're not going to get strategic autonomy unless you have, you know, defense expenditures like 5%, 6%. Then you can start talking about it.
Definition of the hybrid warfare says that it employs political warfare and blends conventional warfare, irregular warfare, and cyber warfare with other influencing methods, such as fake news, diplomacy, foreign electoral intervention. Russia has been clearly running various types of hybrid operation against the West for the last 15 years. What actually constitutes the security or resilience of the society? Is there any difference to ancient societies? Do we have any playbook how to make us more resilient?
I think the Russians, you know, if you look at it, they've been doing it since 1920. So it's not as if this is new. The problem is that is Western silos. I mean, they see a conflict or war as a continuum that uses anything they want. So this kind of thing about, you know, hybrid war and Gerasimov, well, it's not as if that's a new thing. I mean, if you go back to, I mean, at least in recent memory, we have Operation Infektion.
Yes, 1984, right?
Well, it began then, but, you know, back then, before social media, it took like 2 years to get from some provincial Communist Party newspaper in India to Der Spiegel, right? And today it moves in a matter of seconds. But my point is that this is not new. What is new is how effective and coordinated it can be in the digital era. That is new. But it's not as if the Russians have invented anything new. I mean, political warfare, disinformation, hacking is just a more sophisticated form of espionage, is something we've had all the time. What you see is it works better. I mean, if you look at how these things are coordinated, you see one hacking group go into Hillary Clinton's server and take out the files, then the FSB feeds it to WikiLeaks, which then broadcast this, and then sections of what are broadcast are then promoted on Facebook by the so-called Internet Research Agency. So all that, I mean, it's It's just the technological means to do that are greater today than they were before.
So it's faster, it's more intensive, and it's more effective. But yeah. Is there any way how we can react to boost our resilience against it?
Well, clearly one way of doing it is to be able to report on it and make our publics know about it. I mean, we have in basically the Nordic, well, say Sweden, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, I don't know about elsewhere, monitor this stuff fairly closely. And when we find something, we talk about it. And I understand Czechia has also worked on this pretty well. Other countries, I don't know. Clearly, Germany has not really been very effective in this regard. So it varies from country to country. And I think that having this kind of effort to monitor and to make public various disinformation campaigns and attempts is something that we need to devote more resources to. And not just say, oh, this disinformation. Well, yes, we know it's disinformation, but what are we going to do about it? And where are the resources? I don't know if things have changed very much in the European Union, but under Federica Mogherini, there was a council decision to monitor disinformation, but it was only funded by the member states themselves, even though it was located in.
Yeah, the money and the resources, they relocated to Brussels. It was practically a joke.
Mm-hmm. Mr. President, when I was listening to your speech in Prague 3 weeks ago, you were talking about cybersecurity and cognitive security as interconnected domains. The story of Hillary Clinton's emails, which you spoke about just a couple of minutes ago, and their use in propaganda campaigns is a clear example of that. But apart from publicizing disinformation campaigns, which you spoke about as well, there needs to be a change how our security agencies operate. They should be collaborating with each other instead of working in silos, right?
Well, we operate both in intellectual silos. So you have universities, you have some people dealing with cryptography, other people with hacking, other departments dealing with disinformation, and they don't share very much. The other problem that we have not addressed very effectively, at least, is that, I mean, you just take two hacking groups, which have different names, but I mean, the most common ones are APT-28 and APT-29, one of which is GRU, and the other one, we don't quite know what it is, but both are Russian. They have hacked inter alia, as I think I mentioned when I was in Prague, but they have hacked the State Department, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Congress, but they've also hacked the Bundestag and the German Stiftungen or think tanks. They've hacked the Dutch Foreign Ministry, the Danish Foreign Ministry, the Italian Foreign Ministry, and who knows what else, because not everyone admits these things. And on top of that, they even hacked WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency. They don't care, nor do they have to care about national borders, whereas the response tends to be strictly national, and we have not really set up the mechanisms by which we really communicate and inform each other and can come up with a united approach to the same groups that attack different countries.
So more integration is the answer. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Since they over there, the people doing this, do not see, they see this all as one thing, a continuum. And they don't say, oh, we don't deal with that because that's hacking, but we deal with this information. And I mean, I had this experience about a year and a half ago where I was interested in deep fakes, which fortunately have not turned into the big thing everyone was worried about. But I went to the NATO Cyber Center here in Tallinn and I said, well, what do you do with deep fakes? And the answer was, well, that's content and we don't really deal with that. We're the cyber center and we deal with you know, technical things. So then I went to this the equivalent, I mean, the sort of its sister or center, the NATO Center for Strategic Communication, which is what deals with disinformation. I said, okay, here we have these, we have this this deep fake thing. What are you guys doing? And they said, well, look, that's technical, because that's not really, I mean, we deal with content, but not with the technical side of this. So, I mean, here was a, what at least at the time seemed to be a new potential threat that was not being addressed because it fell in between two areas. And this is, I mean, that's a perfect example of the kind of intellectual silos that we have to overcome in the West.
We were talking about disinformation and propaganda, and big part of that problem are global social networks and content platforms. In our podcast, we usually talk about Facebook and use them as the main boogeyman, but there are certainly others. Today on Twitter, you have actually published an interesting mini-thread where you have said that instead of futile attempts to regulate digital platforms, we should focus on reforming our systems, namely electoral systems, which means the way how we vote. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, I was thinking mainly, since the main focus of this information and also legislation tends to be the United States, but I mean, the United States electoral system was designed at a time when, I mean, mail traveled by horse. And the U.S. Electoral College was designed the way it was because they said, well, we don't want candidates for president to only go to the big states. And so we'll have to give more. You'll have to run in not just New York and Pennsylvania and Virginia, but you have to go to Georgia and you have to go to Maine and Vermont, which were all small states. And so they designed the system, which was great for the level of technological development of the United States in 1790. Well, here we are, 130 years later, and we have the internet, we have jets, we have all these things, right? Why do we continue something that was designed to overcome limitations in transport of a quarter of a millennium ago? And similarly with electoral systems, the Anglo-Saxon countries all have first past the post single mandate electoral districts because that was simple to calculate. One person won, the other one lost. But most of Europe uses some kind of multiple mandate system, electoral system, which that means you have many people running, some of whom get in, and this way you don't. It's not like you get the polarization that you have in the United States, especially with primary systems, where when you have a primary, you end up getting out of the primary system movement toward the extremes. Who can be more left or who can be more right? It's true. It was difficult in the 1790s to actually compute representation. I mean, there are various systems, but we'll take here in Estonia, we use the Dahont method of single transferable votes. That's a little tricky stuff, but it's easily done in the era of computers to look at how many votes different parties get in an electoral district. I mean, you can end up with, you know, one hard right and one hard left and two social democrats and three conservatives and one liberal, and that gives you a much better representation of a society and the desires of that society than a first past the post electoral system.
You suggest that there is a time to come to adjust those constitutions, and do you think it's doable given the fact how destabilized are the legislation bodies thanks to extremist parties and the Bannonist grassroots radicalization done by social media?
I don't think it's extremely likely, but I occasionally just write or tweet that or write about it just to keep people thinking about maybe the solution is not to come up with complex methods to control social media, which of course immediately always run into the freedom of speech issue. The problem of social media comes from modern technological developments. Why do we not adjust our electoral systems to take into account that we live in a new era? Being a realist, I don't see things like that changing until there is massive awareness of it. On the other hand, you have some pretty horrific numbers where you can, I mean, the losing candidate can get several million more votes in the popular vote, but lose. I mean, that's not democratic either. On the other hand, I mean, the Czech Republic and most of Europe actually isn't that polarized. Yes, we talk about the hard right and the hard left in our countries, but they're not a problem the way you have in countries with first past the post electoral districts. I mean, you know, the level of populism you see in the United States and in, say, the UK really is quite worrisome.
Current social media are being called behavioral manipulation platforms. This notion was made quite popular by the Netflix Social Dilemma movie, which was seen by a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So if we follow that path of behavioral manipulation and harvesting behavioral profiles at scale, isn't TikTok, the rapidly growing global social network created by a Chinese company, isn't it a long-term geopolitical risk for our society? Aren't Chinese harvesting behavioral profiles of our youngest generation, which in turn will give them a long-term advantage in the future?
Well, it seems to be, but I don't see how you stop that. I mean, we live in we have market economies. We don't censor. So it's up to someone to come up with something better than TikTok.
But historically, we would regulate our public space. We would give licenses to broadcasting media, to televisions, and so forth. Why don't we develop similar structures for regulating digital space, for regulating social media algorithms, as an example?
That's actually the reason why we made the public media after the World War II, because the unlimited propaganda was just a huge problem.
Well, I do not see right now any mechanisms for doing it, because if you can't stop TikTok in Russia, how do you expect we're going to be able to do it in the Czech Republic or Estonia?
Do you think we should do something similar, like be proactive instead of reactive, as an example around our own information operations against their populations?
Well, I don't see a problem with that, but then again, some people probably do. I certainly agree in informing people, and I think that that's the job of where I used to work 40 years ago or 35
right,
years ago, Radio Free Europe. And they are doing some of that, but, you know, they're still sort of, I mean, they're somewhat limited, right?
Okay, so we are running out of time, so let's close this out, right, Alex?
Thank you so much for being with us and taking your time.
I always want to work with my friends in the Czech Republic, that is one of the countries in Central and Eastern Europe who actually gets things, understands things.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you. So, this was our first English episode of Canaries in the Net, and definitely not the last one. But there is more to come. Our second guest of this summer will be someone who can give you a big picture of the American insurrection and its roots. So stay with us. You won't regret.
You can find us at www.canaries.life, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to give us likes or stars, which will help us to get our podcast to more people.
Music and sound was produced by Psyek from deafmutedrecords.com. Thanks for listening, and stay with us.